Blog Talk Radio.
Y'all hear me out. Express yourself. Come on, y'all. Express yourself.
Beverly Black. I am the creator and the host of Expressions of Blackness, and that right there is our good friend of Tribe Family Channel, Mr. Charles Wright. You already know. Express yourself. Ooh, this man's wife history is chronicled in Up From Where We've Come. He is the child of sharecroppers. He is a former sharecropper from Mississippi, all the way to Los Angeles, to be the founder of the Watts 103rd Street Rhythm Band. Baby, Express Yourself is brought to you by Tribe Family Channel, a gumbo for the soul, international family brand. Expressions of Blackness is proud to have on our show today Danny Smith Mathis, educator, homeschooler, author and contributing writer in Everyday Struggle, How Toxic Workplaces Impact Black Women by Dr. Carrie Yazid. Now, Danny Smith Mathis is a writer, a poet, a mother of three, and grandmother of two young princes. She is the granddaughter of a former Pullman porter and the daughter of a former Tuskegee Airman, who was the first black person to become the president of any college or university in the state of New Jersey, and a second grade school teacher. Now, she has a rife history. She has acquired many things, including a Bachelor of Arts. She is an alumni of the Carnegie Mellon University Black Alumni Association and a graduate of the university, where she received her Bachelor of Arts in Creative Writing. So she is also a graduate of the University of Southern California, where she received a Master's in Professional Writing. I love that she is an overcomer and a survivor, a thriver of domestic violence, and knows the importance of self-care. And we will be going down that road when Danny Smith Mathis comes back to Tribe Family Channel in March, Women's History Month, March 17th. But without further delay, here live on Expressions of Blackness, it is an honor, privilege, and a pleasure to have the sponsorship and support of this episode by Danny Smith Mathis. How are you doing, my sister?
Sis, I'm doing well. Thank you so much. And thank you so much for your just steadfast in bringing all of this richness to the listeners and to our community, to the world. Thank you so much, sis.
Thank you so much for the acknowledgement. We're going to keep it coming. We are going to keep it coming. So I really have to thank supporters like yourself and other guests. Yesterday we had Mr. David Newby on, and tomorrow we will be having Dr. Maxine Bryan on. But today, our debut show, Mr. Alan T. Black, no relation. So it is a pleasure, and it is because of all of you, the so named, that we are here today. Now, sister, you come from a long lineage of overcomers and achievers in the civil rights era, if you will. As the granddaughter of a Pullman porter, we know the lines that had to be fought and crossed to bring black people to a higher level, to a black middle class. Pullman porters are attributed to having built a black middle class, and you are a lineage of the builders of that trajectory that changed life in America for black people. So we also know that you are the daughter of a Tuskegee Airman. So in the order of your grandparents and that socialization, tell us more about your background and what you know about the lineage and the Pullman Porters and their sacrifices and, you know, of course, your grandfathers.
Well, Beverly, let me just first say this. Storytelling is so critical for our community, still is, because, you know, the griot in Africa, where we originate, it was the storyteller, and it wasn't just to, you know, have something nice to say. It was to bring the legacy to the forefront of those who were his descendants, his or her descendants. And so I want to tell you, you know, we were supposed to come on last week, but I want to tell you how providential this was that we didn't come on last week. Mm-hmm. I did not know until earlier to last weekend that I am the great-granddaughter of a Pullman Porter on my father's side. So I had no idea that my paternal grandfather was, my paternal great-grandfather was also a Pullman Porter like my paternal, like my maternal grandfather. So on both sides
of
my family, one generation removed from each, I am a descendant of two Pullman Porters in two different generations.
Oh, and, wow.
Yes. And let me tell you, and this ties back to storytelling. My father passed away suddenly on Christmas Day in 2001. But prior to that, 25 years prior to that, my father and I were writing his biography together, and he was putting on cassette tape, okay, I'm dating myself, his history. So he was my griot, and so he was telling me the story. Well, I got tired literally last weekend of all my nice LPs, my good old albums from back in the day, just sitting in my garage in crates. So I decided to purchase a 6-in-1 Victrola music player so I could play my album. And that player also played cassette tapes. So I noticed that in some other crates, I had cassette tapes, and there were 7 cassette tapes from my father, whose voice I have not heard in 23 years since he passed. So I plugged in those cassette tapes on Sunday. On Saturday and Sunday, and I listened to all 7 of it, and that's when I found out that his grandfather, my great-grandfather, was a Pullman Porter. I only thought
stop right there. I was trying not to interrupt you, sis. I promise you. But, you know, I'm glad we didn't come on until today, too, because there is a time and a place for everything. And the fact that you have been brought even further up to date of the heritage and the lineage from which you come, and truly on both parents' sides, they have been pivotal in changing the status quo of black history, of black people. The Pullman Porters, again, ladies and gentlemen, if you're just tuning in, I explained earlier in the show that the Pullman Porters were responsible for black people becoming middle class people. Okay,
yes.
And, you know, what I want to know is, first of all, how did it feel? I'm a daddy's girl, and I have VHSs and, you know, recordings of my dad and the dinners we had and the holiday dinners and the family and the kids and him, you know, teaching my sons to play golf and being at my, you know, first home that I purchased. Just all kinds of history and stuff. So how did that feel, hearing your dad's voice? You know, baby girl, I know it was intense, but describing your words.
hearing his voice was soothing, but it was also a reminiscent time, but it also gave me a glimpse of myself. So now my father dies 23 years ago. I was only 43 at the time. I'm 66 now. And so
I'm calling you baby girl. I'm 64. But you know what I mean. I'm talking to the daughter of the father, you know.
Right. So to hear him give me advice, to hear him tell me, you know, so many things haven't changed. He's still here in the moment with all of us because, unfortunately, many things have not changed. But what I will say, it gave me such a comfort to know my history. I never knew his father, so I've only known my grandfather on my mother's side. So I only know what my father was telling me about his people. I knew his mother, but I didn't know his father. And my grandfather, his father, was born in 1875. So imagine him knowing his grandfather, who clearly had to be born at least 1840s, 40, something like that, which was before slavery ended. Women quarters are so important to Black history is because first of all, George Pullman started hiring Pullman porters shortly after the end of slavery. And he intentionally wanted to hire, listen to this, dark-skinned ex-slaves. So why? Because, well, it was twofold. One, it was that they would come and work for him for whatever price, however low. I don't know what they thought about that, but there was a dichotomy of thought between dark-skinned slaves and light-skinned slaves. And if we think that wasn't a real thing, they need to do some homework. And he paid them next to nothing. As long as they worked.
Of course.
He paid them next to nothing. They worked hundreds of hours in a week, right? But the more interesting reason why they hired him was he was trying to sell railroad customers back then on a whole new concept of overnight travel. And so his sleeping cars then doubled. Now, what that had to do with dark-skinned people versus light-skinned blacks, I really don't know. But he was going to convince his passengers somehow that they would be waited on these ex-slaves and who embodied like this whole thing of service to white people. Because invariably, when I've seen movies or documentaries, the slaves that were the butlers and all, they were usually dark-skinned black men. So there has to be some kind of a thought process in that. But more than that, let's talk about us and what it means to us. This Pullman porters, you know, they called them Georges, and they were called Georges because in the tradition of slave ownership, you know, you were named after your slave master. So the Pullman porters were called the Georges of the train, right? But they were people that really started and solidified the black middle class. And there's a book called The Making Rising from the Rails. Actually, it's a CD that you can get. And it's called Pullman Porters and the Making of the Black Middle Class. And it's by I can't remember Terry's last name, but there was a journalist who wrote this book about Larry Tye, that's his name, Larry Tye. And so Larry Tye wrote this book, and there's also a CD about it. But it really is, Black history is all about what happened on the train lines, I happen to have a picture, and I will stop after this. I happen to have a picture. When my maternal grandfather died, he was born in 1906, just would have been 118 years old just last week, had he still lived. I was the executrix of his estate. I took over the settling of his estate, and I found a picture of him, two pictures of him as a Pullman porter. They had two uniforms.
Lord have mercy.
One was when they were taking the tickets and they had the dark uniforms on and they had hats. And that's that is usually where you see Pullman Porter's photographs with their hats on, and they were taking the tickets and, you know, walking up and down. And then there were those
right.
serving who had, they were dressed up as butlers, right? And so
right.
I have a picture of my grandfather in both uniforms.
And Lord, have mercy.
With him as a butler in his white, he is standing behind then president, the former late Dwight D. Eisenhower, on the Eisenhower
Lord,
train.
Girl,
that picture
stop.
Has his autograph. I have the original autograph picture of President Dwight D. Eisenhower.
You know what? Now, now I have to go here. You forced me. will you be writing a book?
So I am writing my book right now. I am writing, it's turning out to be my memoirs, basically, but it's about my mentors. And my people, my father, my grandfather, my grandmother, all of them will be in the book. And it's going to be basically my life through the eyes of my mentors, and my mentors through, you know, how they imparted all their wisdom on me. And clearly
right.
it began here.
Right,
so, yes.
right.
Well,
oh, awesome, awesome. Well, listen, we're going to take a quick commercial break, but I am fascinated by my current guest, Expressions of Blackness on Tribe Family Channel. We're listening to Danny Smith Mathis and being the granddaughter and the great-granddaughter of Pullman Porters,
yes.
as well as the daughter of a former Tuskegee Airman. She has a life history, and her memoirs will be forthcoming. Her memoir will be forthcoming, and I want to put my name down for an autographed copy when that comes out. I know it's going to take her a good year. Hold on for this commercial break from Tribe Family Channel.
Hey there, my name is Danny Smith Mathis. I am a professional writer, editor, and proofreader. So if you have need of any of those types of services, please visit my website, www.DannySmithMathis.com. That's Danny with an E, SmithMathis.com. Again, writing, editing, proofreading services, if you have need of any of those, please visit my website, www.DannySmithMathis.com. I hope to hear from you. Thank you. Have a great day.
G. James Fleming wrote in the NAACP's crisis in 1937, "As important as is this lucrative contract as a labor victory to the Pullman Porters, it is even more important to the Negro race as a whole from the point of view of the Negro's uphill climb for respect, recognition, and influence and economic advance. In the early 20th century, the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters strove for recognition of their union, a victory whose impact went beyond Pullman Porters to the African American society on the whole. Operation of railroads across the country relied on different classes of workers, conductors and engineers in the operating trades, construction and laborers, and service positions like porters, dining car waiters, and station ushers. The classes of railway workers were segmented along racial and ethnic lines. Workers in the railroad trades began forming brotherhoods in the 1860s and 1870s as a response to the health and safety issues. Many of these brotherhoods codified these racial divisions, barring non-whites from membership. In general, African Americans were confined to the service positions. Thus, it was in the service positions that black trade unionism on the railroads began. The Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters was founded in 1925 in New York City and for four decades was led by A. Philip Randolph. From outside the Pullman Company, he was not susceptible to their reprisals, and his powerful public speaking and work editing the Harlem, New York Monthly, The Messenger helped prepare him for the task. Porters comprised 44% of the Pullman rail car operation workforce, and Pullman was the nation's largest employer of African Americans. The Porters, owing in part to their cosmopolitan experience, held positions of status and respect in the Black community. The union faced tough opposition from a traditionally racist industry, an anti-union corporation, and initially from some of the Black community. Many members of the African American community feared economic reprisals since the Pullman Company offered jobs to African Americans and advertised in the Black press. In 1937, the Pullman Company signed a contract with the Black sleeping car porters, leading to higher salaries, better job security, and increased protection for workers' rights through grievance procedures. It was the first major labor agreement between an African-American union and a corporation. The NAACP crisis credited the victory for broad influence, saying, as important as is this lucrative contract as a labor victory to the Pullman Porters, it is even more important to the Negro race as a whole from the point of view of the Negro's uphill climb for respect, recognition, and influence and economic advancement. The Black sleeping car porters also functioned as a civil rights organization through the 1960s. And we have the legacy of two sides of the family of Pullman Porters, Danny Smith Mathis. Now, sister, what is your response to any of the aforementioned that you may not have already known or that you want to expound upon yourself?
Well, let me just say this, Beverly. So, you know, it's indicative of where we still are, really. You know, as early as 1900, Black porters, you know, they were making nothing. And you know, you mentioned that I wrote a book about Black women and systemic racism in corporate America. Well, the Pullman Porters, you know, what we experience as Black women today is no different than what Pullman Porters were experiencing. They were subject to all these early dismissals or termination based on minor and false accusation by mainly white passengers, you know? White people just didn't want to see this scribe and happen. However, here's what happened. So I'm going back to February 20th of 1918, Kansas City, Missouri. Order of sleeping car conductors, they were organized in Kansas City. And a lot of them, those members had to be white males because the order didn't admit Black people. So who comes along? Randolph. He starts organizing those brotherhood of sleeping car porters, and their motto was basically fight or be slaves. That's it. So 7 years later, 500 porters, they meet in Harlem. They decide to galvanize themselves under Randolph's leadership, and it was the first Black union. That was the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters. So you had the Order of Sleeping Conductors that was all white, but then you have A. Philip Randolph 7 years later organizing them under fight or be slaves, and they established the Brotherhood of Sleeping Cars. And that was formed slowly under these terrible working conditions, and eventually those conditions improved and the salaries improved. But by forming that became the first Black labor union, and it laid the groundwork for the civil rights movement. That's why A. Philip Randolph the March on Washington in 1963. That March on Washington was a culmination of efforts that had long, long been established before 1963.
Wow, wow, wow. I love what you have to say and just the history behind your knowledge base. It's not something that you heard. Passed on into history and time through you, and I cannot wait until you continue the story. Now, we're going to switch over to
Beverly, before we switch, I do want to suggest that everyone know about the A. Philip Randolph Pullman Porter Museum in Chicago. The founder
definitely.
Of that is sister by the name of Lynn Hayes. It's located on the south side of Chicago. And it's housed in this original row house that was built by George Pullman to house workers. So here we have this National Historic Landmark. And the museum houses a whole collection of artifacts and documents. And in fact, I am going to get in touch with Lynn myself. I've met her personally, and I'm going to give her a copy of this picture that I mentioned earlier that I have autographed by the original picture autographed by President Dwight D. Eisenhower with my grandfather on the train in the picture with him.
Oh, that needs to be a whole ceremony.
That needs to be a whole ceremony.
I mean, this is history, and this is family legacy, and something of that level of antiquity. Because antiquities, we are talking, you know, way, 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 way back. But this is civil rights history. This is Black history. This is, you know, what caused, like you said, the Union is the beginning of civil rights, you know, the civil rights era. And so it's really fascinating, and I believe that that's just my opinion, that it should be a ceremony and that you should be there so that we can see what the heritage of Pullman Porters looks like through your lens. Expressions of Blackness. Absolutely, Queen. Now, if you're just tuning in, we're on Tribe Family Channel's Expressions of Blackness. I am Beverly Black, and I am thrilled to have Dani Smith Mathis expressing her blackness. We'll be right back after this word.
Brooklyn speculative fiction author Kathy Wright Lewis penned and published Mariah Seed, Why Hope Lives Behind Project Walls, Passion's Pride, Return to the Dawning, Mamarelli and Mamarelli's Lessons, children's book series, and a host of poetry anthologies and short stories. Her allegorical Afrofuturistic works both uncover the history of African Americans in New York City, honors the African ancestors who built the city and those who fought for equality amid centuries of disenfranchisement and massacres. Students in mind, Wright Lewis strategically embedded core knowledge of language skills that ordinarily prevent urban students from mastering language and writing skills within her text. She also uses language and culture that connect students of color and invite them on journeys about their lives. For over 35 years, Wright Lewis served Brooklyn youth, adults, and teachers as a high school English teacher, mentor, UFT teacher trainer, and English professor. She continues to serve students through Megar Evers College Center for Black Literature as program director of Re-envisioning Our Lives Through Literature, and as executive director of her nonprofit Power in the Pen Writing Workshop, Inc., Kathy Wright Lewis, where culture and literacy and spirit meet.
Welcome back live to Expressions of Blackness. I am Beverly Black. My guest is Dani Smith Mathis. She is the great-granddaughter of a Pullman Porter, the granddaughter of a Pullman Porter, and also the daughter of a Tuskegee Redtails Airman. We have been talking about the Pullman Porters, and as we segue to the Tuskegee Airmen, I just want to offer this brief insertion. The Tuskegee Airmen were a group of African American and Caribbean-born military pilots, fighter and bomber, who fought in World War II. They formed the 332nd Fighter Group and the 477th Bombardment Group of the United States Army Air Forces. The name also applies to the navigators, bombardiers, mechanics, instructors, crew chiefs, nurses, cooks, and other support personnel. All Black military pilots who trained in the United States trained at Grill Field, Kennedy Field, Moulton Field, Shorter Field, and the Tuskegee Army Air Fields. They were educated at the Tuskegee University, formerly Tuskegee Institute, located near Tuskegee, Alabama. The group included five Haitians from the Haitian from the Haitian Air Force and one pilot from Trinidad. It also included a Hispanic or Latino airman born in the Dominican Republic. They were best known for the extraordinary efforts in the air war of World War II and for challenging the stereotypes that had kept Black Americans from serving as pilots in the U.S. Armed Forces. Ladies and gentlemen, Danny Smith Mathis is the daughter of a Tuskegee Red Tails airman. Please, Danny, give us your remembrances and the stories and what you would like to expound on about the Tuskegee Red Tails airmen. And I would like to say that just for the audience in fair transparency, I had the pleasure of being the brand manager for Colonel Richard Tolliver, who was a second generation Tuskegee Red Tails airman. But now we have the daughter of a Red Tails Tuskegee airman. Please expound for us, Danny.
Thanks, Beverly. Well, let me just clarify a few things. I have the only artifact. Well, there's two. I have a photo of the red tail that my dad did train in, and I have my father's Tuskegee Airman photo. He looks like a baby, honestly. His official, with his official bomber jacket on. But my dad was a member of the 477th Bombardment Group Tuskegee Airmen. They did not fight. Here's what Dad said on the tapes that I just listened to. So what he explained to me was this. The pilots, they had to separate those who were good in math and those who were great in math, okay? And and the ones who were great in math end up being the bombardier navigators. That's what my father was. He was a member of the 477th Bombardment Group. Extraordinary.
Wow.
Those airmen were the airmen who they say could fly with their eyes closed. They knew angles so well that they said they could fly with their eyes closed and land properly. Mm. And that's just how the math wizardry that was embedded in these Black aviators' minds, right, as part of this bomber crew. Now, let me tell you how I found out. The most interesting story is how I found out father was a Tuskegee Airman. So, as you mentioned in my
Hold that thought, because I know you're not going to forget. Let me just say something about what you just said, sister.
Okay.
You spoke to the level of genius and the capabilities of mathematical equation and the, thought processes of higher study when it came to Black people back then, and as it still remains today. See, we were studied and always marginalized as unintelligent and put down. And when you go back to our history, you find that we were very intellectual and highly educated. And so I just wanted to make that note that we come from a people of such knowledge and prowess that it's the acumen of our intellect is not amassed in its full potential. But go ahead.
Right. Yeah. So not only that, this bombardment group, it was activated on June 1st of 1943, but it was inactivated a month later, just a couple of 2.5 months later, basically. And then they were reactivated as the 477th composite group in a couple of years later. So they went through a lot of changes, but these men, basically, they didn't get to fight in the war because the war was over. They trained as navigation of that. understanding, I'm happy to be corrected by anyone who's listening and has a clear history of this group. And one of the reasons why I don't know a whole lot is because my father hated the South. My father, on his tape, mentioned the time he got to Biloxi, Mississippi, when he was in the U.S. Army Air Force, and how he was, and just he had never been so frightened in his life. I mean, I heard it in his voice. First time I heard my father be afraid of men. And it just so happens that the men that were calling him when he got off the train to report to duty down there were black men, but he couldn't see them because they were in the distance and they were called, it was nighttime and he couldn't see them. They were a boy and he thought they were white men. Anyway, I found out my dad was a Tuskegee Airman one summer after I graduated from Carnegie Mellon University. And like you said, Beverly, I do serve on the board of Carnegie Mellon University Alumni Association now, as a matter of fact. And I'm also a member, of course, of the Black Alumni Association. But when I graduated from Carnegie Mellon in 1979, the summer, I remember once that summer or the summer later, 1980, I believe it was, I was looking at an Ebony magazine. Now, this was before a digital world, right? And there were real magazines to look at and flip through. And Ebony always had these great black and white photos at the end of the magazine, you know, like that was their nostalgia, right? And so I happened to look at this picture of this group of men in front of this airplane, and it's a black and white photo, and it was really, really more sepia than anything. And I'm looking, and I look at this, looking at all these men, and I'm like, that looks like my father. Now, of course, here
I am. Oh, my goodness gracious.
I'm 22 years old. I don't really know what my dad looks like when he was my age at 22 or 20, whatever that was. I mean, I don't know what my father looks like as a young man. And I had seen his wedding photos, but I hadn't seen anything before he married in 1957. So here I am looking at this photo, and I'm like, God, that looks like Dad. But it's just like my mind, right? So I go downstairs. My father's in the room watching a baseball game. And I said, Dad, this looks like you. And he said, that is me, dear. Tuskegee Airmen. That's how I found out my father was a Tuskegee Airman.
You know, excuse me. You mentioned Biloxi, Mississippi. My minister and mentor, Dr. Jackson, his parents were from Biloxi, Mississippi. And it is a trip to really hear about the egregious acts of inhumanity imposed upon our people back then. But now to what you were saying about how you found out your father was a Tuskegee Airman, I can relate to that going back to my minister, because he didn't talk about his role as the leader of the Tugulu Nine, led, trained, and mentored by the late, great Medgar Wiley Evers. When I wanted to have the Tugulu Nine on my radio show in 2016, they had to go find him. Dr. Geraldine Hollis of the Tugulu Nine had to go find Joseph, and she put the brakes on, and I let her put the brakes on. And I bring him up because once he was on the radio show and we went through years of the interviews and everything, and then when the show was over, season it ended, I wouldn't let him go. I said, you don't know who you are. And he thought I was crazy. And I may have sounded crazy. I said, but you don't know who you are. You are a civil rights icon. But he had laid all of that aside. And see, your father laid all of that aside until his baby girl came down those stairs with that picture. Because what? He hated the South, like you said. So our people weren't, you know, trying to, let me tell you what I did back here with Jim Crow. Come on now. And we're uncovering these gems filled with historical facts on how this country was stitched together. And like I told Dr. Jackson, and I'm telling you too, you're woven all into it. You see?
Yeah.
You're woven all into the history. So go ahead. And what was your reaction when your dad clarified that that was indeed him in the picture?
Well, you know, I'd never heard of them before. So that was an educational moment for me. And so I just didn't know the significance. I didn't know that there was a 99th and there was a 332nd and then there was a 477th and the 99th was Benjamin O. Davis and then this was under the command of General Benjamin O. Davis and then the 332nd was his son, you know, under the command of his son, from what I understand. And then 477th came about and it was World War II ended. So my father fought in the Korean War. He was in the U.S. Army mm-hmm. Air Force. He fought in the Korean War, but he didn't fight as a Tuskegee Airman, but he did train. So that is what I know.
Well, thank you for his service. He did fight, and thank you for defending freedom that we so carelessly take for granted.
Absolutely.
And rest his soul. Rest his soul. Well, we're going to go to our last commercial break here on Expressions of Blackness. I am Beverly Black, and it is an honor, privilege, and a pleasure to be speaking with Danny Smith Mathis here on Tribe Family Channel, a Gumbo for the Soul International Family Brand.
In our lives every day, we are faced with difficult challenges that overwhelm us, that take a lot out of us emotionally, mentally, and physically. There are so many things that we can't control. Being held down by the struggles of life, we seek a transformation and a need to connect to the Lord, trusting in Him to complete us and to direct and lead us in the right path. From song lyricist and Christian author Alan T. Black comes his latest book, Just a Closer Walk, sharing the story of a journey that is sure to resonate with each reader. Just a Closer Walk is the third book for best-selling Christian author Alan T. Black. For more information, please visit alantblack.com. That's alantblack.com.
And we are back live on Expressions of Blackness. Thank you, Alan T. Black. No relation, but he's my brother from another, and I appreciate his sponsorship and his listenership. He's enjoying the show along with many other listeners, and we appreciate the list that we have. If you want to talk or have a question for our speaker, just press 1 and we'll open up your line and welcome you in on these last few minutes that we have. Now, what I like, segueing into Alan, most of all, he opened up this season of Expressions of Blackness. And he and I discussed spirituality very heavily. You know, and when I think about the Civil Rights era and the Tuskegee Airmen and the Pullman Porters, their resolve, when you think about Frederick Douglass and Harriet Tubman and the North Star and being guided and led, you know, being enslaved people and believing in the power and the gift of God to free us. Can you imagine the spiritual resolve and the foundation that their faith is built upon? Come on now, because our little tree gets shut. They shake our tree today, and we crying. You know, but here, look at what our people have come through, Danny.
Yeah.
And it's built on a foundation of such resolve and strength. What brings you through, and I know we're going to have you here back with us in March, but, you know, we have mm-hmm. a few minutes left. Let's talk about the level of resolve that is comprised of you and your ability to navigate. And the reason why I ask is because, you know, we're socialized by our foremothers and fathers and what they have experienced and how they've responded, and they pour down in to our spirits. And what level of resolve do you have poured down into your spirit by the legacy that you've come from?
Beverly, that's a great question. And let me answer it by saying this. I was 5 years old when the March on Washington movement was established. And let's bring this into context of a larger story, because the largest story about the March on Washington is not the I Have a Dream. You know, respectfully, that is not what that was about. That was the backdrop to the I Have a Dream speech was exactly where we started this conversation. That was Ace Randolph, who was instrumental in preparing with Bayard Rustin, by the way. That whole march was the driving force behind the civil rights movement. And all the civil rights organizations coming together. And he formed and led those Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters. It began in 1925. His leadership in the March on Washington movement was organizing middle and lower class black people to come together. In fact, it was a lot of different people coming together. But his leadership was the strategy that defined the nature of that March on Washington movement. And so I remember at 5 years old, my parents getting on a bus in Newark, New Jersey, where is my birthplace and my mother's birthplace. I remember them boarding a bus to go to march on Washington. I remember the sign that my father had in his hands, I am a man. I remember that sign. My mother hadn't thrown that sign out. I mean, she was getting ready to move, and it was just a sign to her at the time, you know. But I remember that, and I remember, you know, my parents as working class people who were considered at the time middle class black people. And even though today they would just be, you know, working class people, I mean, you know, I don't know anything else. But what I do know is that my father was, I come from a patriarchal black family where the man was leading the home. The woman was supporting, black woman was supporting and right next to that man. And she was cooking for her family. She was working outside of the home too. But she was home, raising, rearing us and doing homework with us, taught me penmanship. That's my mother. I'll save her for next month. But what I do know is that my resolve as a person from the books that I've written about my experience with systemic racism in corporate America comes from the legacy that my father and mother left as black people, really fighting against the system. And it was this whole memory that I have of them getting on this bus and then bringing home a book, a souvenir book from the March on Washington, which I still have. That book is 63 years old. And I still have that book.
It would be nice if you would post some of this stuff on social media. I'm sorry to cut you off.
I'm trying to throw all my gems on social media before I get it down in writing.
I know you can't waste, chronicling, by throwing it on social media. I really, as a writer and a publisher, I know that. That's why I cut in with, such a such a non-professional way of saying it, Well, it would be nice if we could see it, but I know in time and I'm willing to wait. But the historical values that you're bringing forth out of these struggles and your witness to your parents being in these struggles and phenomenally, my mentor, Dr. King, was his role model. So I've heard him, talk about King just so very much. I had him have the director of the King Library from Stanford on our show. That was one of his desires, and I grew up a stone's throw from Stanford, so we made that connection happen. And just your walking history and legacy is something that I really anticipate that you'll be sharing more of, especially on the
the matriarch side as well next month on March 17th, 2024, ladies and gentlemen. For those of you who plan to tune in, Danny Smith Mathis will be back. Now, wow, this has just been such a great, great, phenomenal and enlightening show. You know, I wanted to draw out of you, you know, you're a friend of the show. You've been here, your family, and, you know, we've had many discussions. And so I was challenged, okay, let me draw out of Danny, you know, knowledge and discussions that we haven't had before. You know, I've got to come at you, you know, a whole different angle. But you have such a rife knowledge base, and I just, you know, I love your voice. I love how, you know, you present and all of that. You know, you are a well-read and thorough lady, queen, and I appreciate you. As a former homeschool parent, had you taken it upon yourself to also teach Black studies at home? I know that may sound like a crazy question. Talking to, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Rephrase. I'm sorry. Say the question again, sis. I didn't quite get it.
Well, as a home, as a parent, as a homeschooling, former homeschooler.
Yes.
Did you infuse Black studies into the homeschooling? I know that may sound rhetorical, but I just want you to go down, or not rhetorical. It may sound rhetorical, because how could you not? But I'm saying that because I want you to go down that road as to how you, in fact, infused the Black experience into homeschooling.
Let me explain it this way. It is just experience to us.
Right.
I never want to make the dichotomy of thought in my children. Not, and my parents didn't do it with me, so neither would I do it with generations. There is no dichotomy between this. Our experience is our experience. We happen to be Black people, so we have cultural experiences that are different, just like everyone has their cultural experience. Other people, ethnicities have their cultural experience that are different from ours. But the difference, we see why God defines the difference. And when you make sure that children understand that God defined the difference and not man or mankind is defining the difference, that's the first level of education that I will always instill, that I instilled on my children, my grandsons, and anyone who's coming after me or anyone who is put under my tutelage. They have to know that. I've taught white children. I've taught Black children. I've taught brown children. I've taught Native American children. I've taught all kinds of people, disabled people. None of it matters. My father had a speech, and the last interview he gave at the University of Delaware was, "The difference makes no difference." When we define the difference as making a difference, that's the problem in America. We have defined the difference as making a difference.
And you know God, what I hear? Go ahead.
God made the difference. And that is where it begins and ends.
And,
and
know,
it doesn't believe in him or not. It is the truth of that we are different. You can look at people and tell we're different. So what? So what?
Well, and what I love is that, you see, the baton is then picked up and you're not allowing anyone to be marginalized and defined, and lines, color lines being drawn. And the only way that that stops is when we accept that we are in America having our own experience and our own history, and it's part of the human experience, and it's also part of the American experiment. And we have, if everything that we as a people were to shut down, it wouldn't just affect us. So we are all interdependent and interwoven in this experience. And so, like I said, the marginalization is that trajectory is changed when people like yourselves teach like you do and did. And I appreciate you, Danny Smith Mathis. What are your final words for our audience? We're going to get ready to close it out here on Expressions of Blackness. This is episode 3. I'm Beverly Black on Tribe Family Channel, a Gumbo for the Soul International Family brand. You are going to be able to hear these archives from our studio at blogtalkradio.com/Gumbo for the Soul. We're on Facebook at Tribe Family Channel. We're also on LinkedIn, Beverly Black Johnson, X, a.k.a. Twitter, at Tribe Family US, at Gumbo for the Soul. And if you're ever interested in booking the leader of the Tougaloo 9, you can go to the Tougaloo 9 or email thetougaloo9@gmail.com. I am a representative. Danny Smith Mathis, final words for our audience. You are such a phenomenal lady queen. And I can't wait to get you back over here, because we're definitely going to be talking about how everyday struggle, how toxic workplaces impact Black women. You know we're going to talk about this, but go ahead.
So my final words would be this. My paternal grandfather was a Garveyite. We didn't touch that, but he was a follower of Marcus Garvey. And one of Marcus Garvey's quotes is this: intelligence rules the world. Ignorance carries the burden. You have to decide what side of the fence you're going to be on.
And on that note, ladies and gentlemen, we are going to close out. We have a brief commercial. And I want to thank you once again for your sponsorship here on Tribe Family Channel. What do you have going on? Where can our listeners find you if they want to hook up with you?
Danny Smith, www.DannySmithMathis.com. And I'm also on LinkedIn. Everything social media, if you pull up Danny, D-A-N-N-E, Smith Mathis, you will find me everywhere on social media. There's no other Danny like me.
Thank you so much once again, Queen. And that's going to wrap it up for us. I'm Beverly Black on Expressions of Blackness via Tribe Family Channel, a Gumbo for the Soul International Family brand, created, owned, and operated by yours truly. We will be back on the airwaves tomorrow, Expressions of Blackness with Dr. Maxine Bryant for episode 4. Thank you for tuning in. Have a blessed evening.
Blessings, everyone. This is Mike Oley. Want to know more about Black history? My dear friend, Dr. Maxine Bryant, boldly takes her audience on an insightful journey covering information about the Black diaspora that's often left out of the history books. From the greatness of ancient Africans who invented toothpaste and performed C-sections, to the survival ingenuity of captured and enslaved Africans, to Blacks here in the United States whose inventions included traffic signals and color monitors for desktop computers. Dr. Bryant shares accurate truths. Consider this for a dynamic, thought-provoking, an inspirational experience. I encourage you to retain Dr. Maxine Bryant for your next workshop or conference. All you got to do is contact Patricia Maltz today to book Dr. Maxine Bryant. 612-685-1258. 612-685-1258. Oh, by the way, tell him Mike Oley sent you.
Tribe Family Channel.